This is the Bird Hugger Podcast with Katherine Greenleaf, the podcast for people who love birds.
Welcome to the Bird Hugger Podcast. I'm Katherine Greenleaf, and I'm so glad to be with you. I'm on board for a full 30 minutes of talking all things birds and restoring native habitat.
What happens when a burnt-out college professor living in New England decides to become a wildlife rescuer and rehabilitator? Find out on Bird Hugger, the podcast for people who love birds. Join host Katherine Greenleaf, who has been rehabilitating injured wildlife for 20 years, and hear how you can turn your backyard into a native oasis for birds.
Hello there, everybody. Well, we've turned the clocks forward. We're starting to receive the native plants and trees we ordered by mail. Birds are starting to pour in from all points south and are looking for the ideal yard to nest and rear their young. It looks like spring is just around the corner. Finding a safe nesting spot is absolutely key to the survival of birds and their nestlings. On that note, today we have with us Phil Brown, the Bird Conservation Director from the Harris Center for Conservation Education, to fill us in on their new Kestrel program. Their project aims to provide nest boxes for kestrels in the Monadnock region of New Hampshire. The goal is to boost population numbers and to underscore the importance of grassland habitats. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. If you are enjoying this show and like what we do, please help us out by subscribing or following us on your favorite app to access our free show. That way you'll get notified of what's coming, you'll never miss a show, and it will help us in the ratings. And now I'd like to welcome Phil Brown to the show. Phil, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Katherine. Good to be on the show.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. We had quite a resounding response to the interview we did with you on the nighthawk. People are very interested in the nighthawk natural history and how that bird is doing. And so we thought we'd have you back to talk about kestrels, another bird that you're very, very knowledgeable about. And as we go through the interview, we will be talking about your Kestrel project and how that got launched. But first, could you reacquaint our audience with yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started working in bird research.
Okay, sure thing. Yeah, I often say that I'm a lifelong birder. I got interested as a little kid, I think was about 7 years old, from spending time going to Florida to seeing the big wading birds up close. It was particularly engaging for a little kid without binoculars at the time to see nature up close. So I'm a big advocate of making sure nature is accessible for people in that regard. But I kind of had a somewhat unlikely path to being a conservationist, perhaps, growing up in Staten Island, New York, which was highly suburban and city. It wasn't the obvious place to connect with nature, but I had enough encouragement from my parents that they saw the spark that I had with birds, and they helped me find a local bird club. And this really helped my learning take off because of the various mentors who would take me out on field trips. So I pursued wildlife management and bird research later on in college and in graduate work. And really all throughout my life, I've pursued that journey of working with birds and in nature. I came up to New Hampshire about 20 years ago and was able to work for New Hampshire Audubon for 17 years, managing the Audubon wildlife sanctuaries around the state, doing stewardship work and connecting people to nature. Those things are really central to who I am. In the last couple of years, I've been working with the Harris Center. I'm their bird conservation director now, and I get to practice the stewardship piece, the education and outreach, and doing more bird conservation research, which was really where it all began, I think, in some way for me. So I'm happy to talk a little bit about the Harris Center too. The Harris Center for Conservation Education is a regional land trust in southwestern New Hampshire, often called the Monadnock region. We were founded in 1970, mostly in response to the environmental movement of that time and the pressures that were going on in the world around us in the natural world. We started as a land trust and also as an educational organization. And we've expanded since then to do a lot of conservation research, connecting people with science through community or citizen science projects. And in the last few years, that area has really been growing for the Harris Center. So the bird work has taken off. We have a Nighthawk migration monitoring project. We've worked closely with project partners at Hawk Mountain Sanctuary, focused on broad-winged hawks. We manage a raptor observatory in Peterborough, New Hampshire, the Pac Monadnock Raptor Observatory, that connects thousands of people with raptor migration. And there's also a suite of access to the trails and lands that the Harris Center owns and manages. We offer hundreds of programs annually also for people of all ages and backgrounds, a lot of in-person projects and also some in the virtual world. And yeah, I'm really excited to be part of this organization every day.
The Harris Center is such a wonderful organization. You guys are doing such great work. And now you're trying to help the kestrel. Can we talk about the kestrel for a moment? Maybe it's natural history, a little bit of background just to bring our listeners up to speed.
Sure thing. Yeah, we should start in the beginning for those who might not be familiar with kestrels. What is a kestrel? It's often referred to as the sparrowhawk, one of its old colloquial names. It's the smallest falcon in North America and among the smallest of the raptors. It's about the size of a blue jay or a robin, if you're familiar with those species, but it's truly a bird of prey. It kills its own prey. It feeds on insects, small mammals, small birds, a variety of other small living prey. They're pretty recognizable to a lot of people and certainly very charismatic once you get to know them because of their beautiful plumage. Kestrels, you could often describe them as being kind of like a slate gray or bluish color. The males in particular have more of the bluish, and they contrast with a reddish brown coloration. Pretty striking for a raptor to have that combination of colors. Most hawks that we think of are fairly brown and really kind of match the surrounding woodland scapes of the brown tree trunks and leaves blending in. So why do kestrels look so colorful? I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but the fact is they're really something to look at. The females are a little bit more brownish red overall, but still very striking as a bird of prey. And they're recognizable also because they perch a certain way. Kestrels are often in prominent perches on top of dead trees or on phone or utility wires, poles, tops of buildings. They historically have been very close to people in where they've chosen to nest and to feed. They're a bird of open country. And when you think of open country, especially in New England, these are typically managed landscapes, farms, pastures, areas that have some sort of agricultural presence in general. And that's where you're going to find kestrels really throughout their life cycles. They're not birds of the woodlands. And they do migrate, so you will find them flying over wooded areas where there are ridge lines that concentrate raptor migration. They've been around people a long time. In particular, those who farm know them pretty well. They have a variety of different names. I mentioned the sparrowhawk. They also are called the killy-killy bird because of their high-pitched call that sounds like killy-killy-killy. That would be the male call during the breeding season. And they're really widespread across the entire Americas. It's not just around here that we have kestrels, but all throughout the Americas, from northern Canada down to southern South America. And the populations in South America are mainly, or several of those populations are non-migratory. So they have lots of subpopulations and different races of kestrel, all within the complex of American kestrel as a species. And there are other kestrels in the Eastern Hemisphere. So yeah, a bird that's really all around. Their global population is estimated at about 4 million. And a little bit more about them, aside from their prominent perching habits, another way you can recognize them is their behavior. They are birds that hover in flight to find prey, not exclusively, but they often do hover over fields looking for an insect or a vole or a mouse, even birds. And when they do perch, they often bob their tails. They have really long tails, and in flight, they have long wings. So they look like a bird that's very stretched out with these long features. And a little bit about their life history, kestrels are what we call secondary cavity nesters. They use woodpecker holes or man-made cavities. So think of birds that use nest boxes in your own backyard, maybe eastern bluebirds, tree swallows, house wrens. Just like that, kestrels need a cavity, obviously a lot bigger because they're a bigger bird. That's really part of the conservation issue that we'll dive into, I'm sure.
I just saw one yesterday. You know, I'm down in Key West, Florida.
Oh, wow.
And the Key West Wildlife Center gets quite a number of first-year kestrels that are migrating for the first time south in the winter, and they get into a lot of trouble down here.
Oh, sure.
I wonder
if there's some of our kestrels from around here.
Could be. I saw one sitting on the top of a palm tree.
Wow.
Just sort of sitting and waiting. You know, they like to sit and wait for their prey. Sit, watch, and wait, right?
Yeah, and that is the other way that they hunt is sit and wait from perches. Yep.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful bird. They're a lot of fun to watch. What is their range from north to south?
Okay, kestrels range. Really widespread throughout North America and into South America. Really, there's almost nowhere in the U.S. that you can go and not have a chance of seeing a kestrel. And into southern Canada as well. And yeah, the populations move through Mexico. There are resident populations in Central and South America. And I believe some of the South American ones are also migratory.
Now, I understand when they migrate, some of them are kind of loners, you know, as opposed to huge kettles of red tails and broadwings that you could see overhead during migration time. Like apparently occasionally they will fly in small flocks, but for the most part, they like being by themselves. So that really kind of sets them apart from other raptors.
Yeah, I can't think of a time where I've seen more than a few in one place migrating together. Although we've had counts of several dozen at the Hawk Watch in New Hampshire in one day. It's usually singly or sometimes in pairs, and we don't know why. But perhaps the pairs are birds that were mated up in the summer, or possibly their siblings. But we don't really have good information about that.
And what is the best time to see one if someone listening were interested in following up and becoming more interested in kestrel behavior? Is there a prime time of the year to watch them?
It depends on where you are. In the northern U.S., they mostly leave for the winter. They'll move south to follow their food. They begin to arrive in parts of the northern U.S. in probably ranging from February through April. And I'd say in the Northeast, the peak of migration is April. And it's one of the easier ways to see them is going to a dedicated hawk watching spot where you have a chance of seeing a kestrel flying over. But if you want to see them in the nesting season, which is what we're really intrigued by at the Harris Center, the time is April and May when they're most active around the boxes. They get pretty secretive when they have their young. The young hatch May into June, and they fledge by sometime in July. After that, there may be a better chance of seeing them because the nestlings are out and they're pretty loud when they're out of the nest. They're squawking for food, begging the parents, as they do when they're in the boxes too, as I've found out in an interesting way. Yeah, I could tell you more about that soon. So it really all depends on where you are. Down in Key West, where you are, it's winter. Probably not. Actually, I do believe there are some populations in the South that are not migratory also.
So now I understand that they have a two-part killing blow. They grab their prey with their feet, and then they deliver a snap to the neck with their beak.
That's what I understand as well, and it's a hard thing to observe. Even though I have seen them hunting successfully, it's usually from a distance, either through binoculars or a scope. But when they're feeding those young in the nest box, they're delivering a lot of food. Those opportunities that we have to see what they're actually eating, which is really interesting as part of the bigger conservation question, what's going on with kestrels? We know they're declining, but they're carrying birds, insects, small mammals, especially, and snakes. A study in Pennsylvania yielded that percent-wise, I think the bulk of a lot of their diet was birds and small mammals. However, they're probably feeding on insects to a high degree. It's just that the insects don't make up a lot of volume of what they're eating, but it's an important element and a big part of what researchers believe might be part of their long-term spiraling downward decline. We've seen over 60 years, we've seen that kestrels have declined 93% according to breeding bird surveys, which were started in the 1960s. And part of that is probably the habitat changing. We know that forests are regenerating, but we also know that fields are imperiled and are managed differently now too. There just aren't as many fallow areas on agricultural farms, and that's been a big cause of concern for kestrels, also for pollinators. That's a similar issue, and we think those two things are linked. There's also been a lot more chemical pesticide use over the years that we believe does play some sort of role in impacting kestrels, either directly or indirectly through the foods that they're eating. Yeah, it's no surprise that there's a shortage of insects, that those studies are all around us in the news, and it has to be related to everything that eats insects, which is the whole list of prey that I just named, relies on that base of the food chain. That's a big part of their decline. But we are also, we believe that we can have an impact by helping kestrels find better homes, for lack of a better term. But kestrels will take to nest box, as I mentioned before. So we're applying nest boxes in private fields. That's a big part of the Harris Center's conservation project right now. We launched this in 2023, just last year, after a pilot season of installing three boxes in the Monadnock region and in choice kestrel hotspots. And we relied on the public database eBird as one of our go-to locations. So based on people's observations, we knew where kestrels were being reported already. We observed that there was a shortage of both natural cavities in the right habitats, what we deem are the right habitats in large fields. So with some well-placed nest boxes, we did see success after the first year. Four of those nest boxes that we applied last year, that we installed, did host kestrels, and they collectively raised 17 fledglings that made it out of the nest last summer. And it was a thrill to be part of that. But this type of project isn't new at all. What the Harris Center is doing is a newer initiative for the Monadnock region, and it's an expansion of a focused effort that's gone on elsewhere in New England and across the kestrels range. There are thousands of nest boxes all across the U.S. and Canada. They fall under the umbrella of the American Kestrel Partnership, which is a larger network. And there are a lot of sub-partnerships that occur as well. For us, we were fortunate to have the expertise and guidance of a man named Steve Wheeler, who's a retired fish and game wildlife biologist. And he's been working with kestrels for about 50 years in New Hampshire, putting up boxes. He's a licensed bander, so he was able to band all the chicks in the boxes as well. And I joined him last summer at our four boxes and was part of that banding process too. And the bands will tell us information if we do get re-sightings of these birds or get them in hand. At least we'll learn something about their longevity and where they disperse to, perhaps. Although it is less common to actually get a band re-sighting, but that does happen from time to time. So yeah, Steve Wheeler has been our real guiding light with this project and has generously contributed his time and expertise. At this point, we've launched 24 nest boxes in 12 different towns in the region. And my hope is that we're able to nearly double that project by the end of this spring in just a couple of months. So we've been actively fundraising for materials. It's not as simple as just banging a few pieces of wood together. You might have a different impression of what a kestrel box looks like, but there's considerable infrastructure to doing it right. And we want to build a box that's long lasting and put it in the right spot and have the landowners give them a level of comfort with where that's going to be and the education required for them to be good stewards of the land in association with the box being in their fields. So It's been a great way to open up conversations with private landowners. Initially, when people found out about the Kestrel project, I was just getting calls and emails left and right. I have a field. Can I put up a Kestrel box? I have a 5-acre field or a 20-acre field or whatever it may be. We realized quickly we needed some criteria to help hone in on what the right places were for Kestrels. And while we don't exactly have too much data yet, after 1 year, we were able to partner with a student from Antioch University, Will Stolsteimer. He helped us create a habitat model as part of his graduate work for where Kestrels will thrive in breeding seasons. So this is based on field size and management type, proximity to roads. We don't want to create a population sink and have Kestrel boxes right along main roads, for example. We also will ask landowners about their use of rodenticides, which is, I know you're aware, as a big issue for bird conservation right now, especially with raptors. So there's a lot that goes into it behind the scenes before putting up a nest box. There's infrastructure includes a big 4x4 post, a metal post that's in the ground that's easy to drive into our rocky New England earth in the spring, sometimes still controlled by ice as well, who knows. So yeah, it's been a really fun and engaging project. We have lots of possibilities for this coming year. I'm looking to install maybe 15 to 20 more this spring. So
I think that is just so exciting that you're already fledging chicks.
Yeah. That was a real thrill. We didn't know what to expect in that regard. We didn't know if any of these boxes were going to get attention from the birds. And it was like Christmas morning when we would go find out, because the process of knowing if the box is being used in a remote field that might be far from somebody's house, it often involves me or an intern going up on a ladder and taking a peek into that box. We use a selfie stick of all things with a cell phone attached to it to stick it into the hole and get a look at who's in there and shoot a little video and see what happens. And so I have 24 videos this spring showing whatever we're going to find. And then we look at the phone to see what's in there. So sometimes it was chicks, sometimes it was eggs. Oftentimes it was bluebirds and tree swallows with their fledglings and nestlings. So just about every box got some sort of attention from birds.
That is great to hear. So for the upcoming year now, any other projects related to Kestrels? Are you going to be expanding your research?
Well, this is probably in the second year. I think we're going to try to do something pretty similar to what we did in 2023 as far as continue to expand the sample size. We do have monitoring in place of all these boxes during the season and determining the number of fledglings that eventually make it out. So really keeping track of that year to year. A lot of the actions now involve communication and outreach, even more so. We just partnered on a story map, which is a really excellent way to engage and translate some of this information about what we're learning about the project and the causes of concern about the decline, giving that information out to the public. Ultimately, though, we would like to partner with a bander or be able to learn more about where these birds are going and how they're moving. And that would involve the use of different types of geolocators, basically tags of some sort, transmitters that will provide detailed information about when and where these birds are moving across the landscapes. So we don't really know where our population in New England is wintering. There are some data out there available from looking at color bands. For example, a few years ago, one of the local birders in the area spotted a Kestrel with a green color band on its leg. And we were able to, a Harris Center staff member was able to get a photo, an up-close photo to determine what those numbers were. We looked up where it was, and it was banded in New Jersey. So we know that at least there's some sort of connection to that particular part of the world. But yeah, it's probably different for many of these birds where they're spending the winter, and where they're declining is a big question still. We don't really know if it's during the fledgling stage, once they left the nest, if it's during the winter, if they're getting eaten by larger hawks, if they're susceptible to diseases. West Nile virus antibodies are carried by many kestrels, so this is something that they've dealt with over the last couple of decades. And there are just other concerns that we're not aware of yet. So yeah, lots to learn still. And I think we're going to get there eventually, but we're slowly building toward that research. And initially just trying to help people better steward their lands for kestrels and a variety of wildlife.
Very exciting. So as we wrap up here, could you maybe tell our listeners, let's say, what could your average citizen do to help kestrels?
Yeah, there are a lot of actions that you can take. I think, as I touched on, one of those first steps is to try to avoid those rodenticides, those chemicals that are limiting insects, that are poisoning key food source for the kestrels in mice and smaller mammals too. So maintaining a natural environment free of chemicals is probably one of the best things you could do to steward the kestrel population that's already here. Planting native plants to support native insects and wildlife is equally important. A lot of studies have shown that native plants host way more native insects and caterpillars and things that are important bird food, especially for those growing nestlings of all kinds of birds and wildlife. So planting native, if you do have the right kind of large field setting, there's no magic number for acreage, but I say if you have a field that might be in the 10 acre range or a couple of fields that add up to that nearby, that might start making me think you could have a chance of hosting a kestrel if we have a nest box in the right place. So definitely reach out to us at the Harris Center. And you can also report your sightings of kestrels to eBird, the database. So anywhere you are, it will give you a geolocation of where that is. You can enter a checklist for wherever you see a kestrel in the breeding season, especially. That would be in New Hampshire. That would probably be March through July would be the time period. So using that database to add to it, and that's what we go to look for where would some of the obvious places be. So yeah, lots you can do.
Just quickly, for people that maybe don't live in the Monadnock region or maybe even out of state, where would be the best source of a kestrel box building plan that they could access, maybe online?
There are several. There are a lot of different designs. So I would start with the American Kestrel Partnership as one resource. In the Mid-Atlantic states, Hawk Mountain Sanctuary is another leader. And I believe they have their own kestrel box design as well. And then many retailers, including wild bird stores, often carry kestrel boxes. So it's not a hard box to find in the grand scheme of things compared to other bird boxes. They're large, so they're a little more expensive, but equally important is finding the right place to put it where it's going to be, you know, more helpful than harmful. So and that's where relying on some of your state experts or regional experts and the birding community can help with that.
Now, do you recommend against cedar boxes because of the aromatic oils they exude? They found to be somewhat irritating to nestlings.
I can't say I'm too knowledgeable about that. We use plain white pine boxes, and the boxes that we use are untreated, of course, so they don't leach anything. And we make them extra long lasting by really keeping the joints in between the wood very tight, so water doesn't get in and start to erode the box and rot it out. And also we use roofing material on the box. So this is a pretty fancy house and it keeps the water out for a long time. So hopefully many of the boxes that we're installing now will still be there in 20 years. We shall find out. Hopefully the kestrels will be in a better place in 20 years too.
That is great. And finally, if people want to donate towards your kestrel project, where can they send donations?
Oh, well, thanks for mentioning that. Yeah, so the Harris Center for Conservation Education is the organization. Our website is www.harriscenter.org. We have lots of ways to get involved on that site, programs of events coming up. But if you go to that main site, there's a big blue donate button on the upper right corner. So thank you for asking. And then the funds go to support our Kestrel project, which is still in its fledgling stage in a way.
Yeah, that is great. Well, Phil, I want to thank you for joining us again. We really appreciate the time and the expertise that you have on both the Nighthawk and the Kestrel. And we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
We hope you have a banner year, Kestrel fledglings.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Kestrels.
I'd like to thank Phil Brown for joining us today. You can find out more about the Harris Center's Kestrel project by going to their website at harriscenter.org.
Join Americans everywhere in the One Third for the Birds movement. Dedicate the back third of your yard to birds and other wildlife. Make this area a quiet zone with no leaf blowers or lawnmowers. Plant native trees and shrubs so birds have plenty of insects to eat. Create a safe haven for birds to nest and raise their young. You will be rewarded with many hours of bird watching fun. For more information on One Third for the Birds, go to the Bird Hugger page on Facebook.
And that's it for today's episode, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Have a great week and enjoy the birds. Bye for now.